Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m., streaming live at those radio broadcast times at richarddugan.com. We podcast these programs, and they're available via SoundCloud, iTunes, TuneIn Radio, Spotify, Stitcher, several other locations as well, and we certainly hope that you will make yourself available to them, and I would highly recommend that you go to the podcasts. Even if you're listening to the radio broadcast, we only get 50 minutes on the radio. And sometimes we go longer. It just depends upon our guests' availability, if they can stick with us for another 10, 20, 30 minutes. And we are always grateful for that because there's always so much more to talk about on these programs. And we never have enough time. I almost feel as though I need to do a 2, 3, 4, 5-parter with each of these guests. And even then, it's not enough time. I also want to let you know, aside from the podcasts, that if you would like to help support what we're doing, if what you hear resonates with you, you like what we're doing and you'd like to support it, we are grateful for all of the support we have received up to this point. I just can't extend my gratitude enough to the folks who have contributed. There's a PayPal link on the homepage as well as the missions page. And if you're listening for the very first time, go to the missions page and you can read about what we are all about. And then at the bottom, there is a link to support us in that regard. We'll take energetic support as well. So we're not that picky in that regard. Today's program, I think you're going to really enjoy. I know I am because it's taking me in a direction that I have been coming from since I was 17 years old, and I am now 58, going on 59, and it's something that has want to say followed me, or I followed it. And usually the way it works is you don't get to choose your path chooses you, so to speak. And today we're going to be talking about the Bhagavad Gita. Now, it's a huge tome. I mean, there's so many different things in it. And today we're going to be focusing specifically on a book entitled Gita, A Timeless Guide for Our Time. And it is translated by our guest, and I thank him for joining us, Isaac Bentwich, MD. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's great to have you on the program.
My pleasure.
Have I reached you all the way in Israel today?
Yes, you have. Wonders of technology.
Well, I love the fact that this is not only a global program from the broadcast standpoint, the podcasts are available worldwide, but that we get our guests from all around the globe, Ireland, Sweden, Italy, Israel. I mean, it's just been quite remarkable. Again, as you say, the technologies that allow us to do this, and quite cheaply, thank you very much. I'm very appreciative of those.
Yeah.
I can only imagine what the long distance call would cost.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for having me. And from your introduction, meeting with fellow Gita enthusiasts is always heartwarming. So I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I only have one small issue with your book, the translation of the Gita, and that is it's too small. I mean, the version of the Gita that I have at home is like 2 inches thick, and it's paperback, but that's not the point, of course. It is the message. And so I want to start there, and I know that this is referenced in the book as well and in other places. What is the main message in, I don't know, a paragraph or two? But we have plenty of time. We've just started here. What's the main message of the Bhagavad Gita?
Look, the Bhagavad Gita, or fondly as it's called, Gita for short, literally means the song of God. Bhagavad, divine, and the Gita, song. It is a guide for our inner journey. And so we'll talk more about the context and the external story, etc. But the essence of it is really a guide for our inner journey. In a nutshell, how do we live our lives here on Earth, such that they serve to for our growth and not not wasted on mundane passing things. I think that the thing that's so beautiful about the Gita is that it's a direct approach to us, saying, "Hey, you don't need to go to a cave. You don't need to look for a different culture or a different religion or a different philosophy. You don't need to look for this or that guru or teacher or therapist. And you most certainly will not find happiness if you keep looking for it outside. Happiness lies within, and we reach it through action, wise action in the world."
Well, Gandhi said today, "The Gita is not only my Bible or my Quran. It is more than that. It is my mother. When I am in difficulty or distress, I seek refuge in her bosom." And I know that there are that was just mentioned. There's the Bible, there's the Quran, there are many other, as I like to refer to them, ancient wisdom teachings. There is the Gita. As far as I am aware, from what I know of the writings, say, for example, of the 66 books of the Bible, I mean, it's only, you know, a few thousand years old. It's not that old.
How old
is the Gita?
Scholars debate the exact timing of the Gita, and of course, the these academic questions are of secondary use to us spiritual seekers. But if you do talk about the objective reality, it's estimated to be from 500 BC is the date. So 2,500 years old. It reflects the ancient Vedantic or Indian teachings or wisdom, which is several thousand years old.
Talk to us a little bit about, this is for clarification of our listeners, what's the difference between the Bhagavad Gita and the Upanishads, the Ramayana, and other works that are the Vedas and so forth?
That's a good question. You know, when some of the, it happened to me more than once that when I went to some distinguished scholar of Indian literature, and I mentioned my enthusiasm and how much the Gita has touched my heart and changed my life, I was sometimes met with a cold shoulder, as it were, because some of the bigger scriptures, the Upanishads, the Vedas, these are bigger scriptures, more well known, more ancient. In volume, the Gita is minuscule. It is only 700 poetic verses. It was written as a poem. We'll talk more about that, I'm sure. But only 700 verses that encapsulate capture the essence of the teachings. People familiar with these broader teachings do notice that it is sort of a the essence, in a way, of these big volumes of work. A later piece of work, very small in volume, captures the quintessence of the ancient teachings, for sure of the Indian ones, but you know, we can talk more about that when you look at it in comparison to in the context of other religions. The essence of all religions is the same ultimately, and I do not know of a scripture that captures this essence better than the Gita does.
Is it because it's older than the others, from that standpoint, that it's tapping into much more ancient times, if you will, whereas the subsequent books, whether it be the Bible or the Quran, they came after. And so there is a certain, this has been stated in many cases, there is a certain amount of, I don't want to say plagiarism, but some of the stories, though characters might have been changed, names, that kind of thing, the general stories are kind of the same.
I would look at it a bit differently, and I'm now talking first not just about the Gita, but about ancient wisdom, Indian teachings. Mm-hmm. In comparison to the monotheistic scriptures of Judaism, Islam, Christianity, we have to realize that each of these scriptures was written by enlightened sages that are trying to convey a wisdom that is difficult to convey in words. Now, you convey it according to the audience with which this teacher, this enlightened being, comes into contact with. And so each of the religions was affected by the social and the external setting of the students. In Indian teachings in general and in the Gita in particular, this is the crystallized essence of the wisdom, the deeper wisdom, which in the more modern religions, which were more family-based, could not be spoken directly. Look at the New Testament. It's only in parts of it that the mystical side is hinted to. First, there was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Now, go understand what this means. So, but most of the Testament is parables and allegories and stories, from which one needs to glean the inner wisdom. In India, this was a society where these teachings were shared with a very few people in monastic setting, where they dedicated their lives to this. This existed in monastic or in secluded areas of other religions as well, but I think that affected much of how the scripture is. And in fact, it's something that we notice right now. I go to the Gita to better understand the Judaism into which I was born and the Christianity for which I have such high regard. I find a clear articulation of the underlying essences of our modern religions.
Well, there are a couple of other areas I want to touch upon before we dive into this. First of all, it took you, many years, nearly a decade to do the translation. And again, it's not a simple process. But it raises a couple of very important questions in my mind. And these are subjects that I have brought up on this program innumerable times when we talk about the ancient wisdom teachings from around the world. The first one is the whole aspect of context. Now, yes. I was reading a preface to the Quran, and yes. It says that you cannot read it from beginning to end and take every word, every sentence, verse, etc., chapter, and book in the literal sense, that it transcends or it crosses back and forth and back and forth from literal to metaphorical to symbolic, etc., etc., as quite honestly, as does the Bible. It does the same kind of thing. And so the whole issue of context, and I'm gonna bring something to our listeners' attention. You're probably familiar or at least aware of this. I was interviewing a rabbi some years ago on this program, and we were chatting away, and this was off the air, but we were chatting away about the Old Testament laws, the Jewish laws, the 613.
Yeah.
And he says, and we got to talking about specifically about the one in Leviticus that the Christians love to use to beat the daylights out of people who are wanting same-sex relationships. And he says, do you know what the context was and why that law was put into place? And I said, no, I don't. And he explained it to me. And the bottom line explanation wasn't because it was evil, because it was a sin to be with same-sex partner. It was for the purposes of not interfering with the procreative process of man, of the human race. That was the reason why it was against the law. And when I heard that, I thought, well, then that changes everything. Because here we are in the 21st century, and good grief, there are dozens of ways in which we can bring new life into this world. So where is the interference with the procreative process of man now? So talk to us about this aspect of context in terms of, I mean, we've seen what's happened with the Quran and how it has been misinterpreted, at least as far as many people that I've spoken with who are familiar with it, who are Muslims, by the extremists. It's been taken to those kinds of things. Has the Gita had that kind of a problem with folks in terms of taking passages out of context?
Oh, absolutely. Even before you speak of passages, the whole whole concept of the Gita, the message of the Gita is easy to misunderstand. Let's say take for the benefit of the listeners, take a step back and say a few words about the Gita and the external story of the Gita. Gita is a dialogue between a spiritual seeker and the master. The seeker is a prince called Arjuna. Master is Krishna, who is the prince's friend, his charioteer, and no less than God incarnate. So in essence, it is this typical Indian imagination, colorful setting of imagine having a friendly chat with God. This is what the Gita is. Now, why am I saying that it's often misunderstood? This dialogue takes place in the least likely of settings. It is at the on the brink of battle. The prince Arjuna is called into battle, defensive battle, against evil family members who are out to kill him, and he refrains, that does not like the idea, is repulsed by the idea of violence, and turns to his teacher and his friend. And what follows is an articulation of the meaning of life, the paths towards happiness, and so forth. And all of that happens in a freeze frame, if you will, as battle is about to embark. Now, easily, many people understand the Gita to be pro-violence. You know, it's not a Sermon on the Mount under a shaded tree overlooking the Sea of Galilee. It is in the midst of battle. And in fact, the teacher tells the disciple, go ahead and fight. This has been taken, and exactly like the examples that you've given, when taken literally, you easily misunderstand it, especially in the Gita, if you don't read the book itself. So it's a pro-violence book. Nothing could be further from the truth. What the teacher is telling the disciple, and in fact, eye level, it is telling each and every one of us, your life is a battle. You have battles at work, in marriage, in relationship. Life is struggle. Do not run away from the world, be in the world, but not of the world. Live your life wisely. You do not find solace by turning your back on the world, surely not by giving in to it, but by seeing the divine all around us. And responsibly through reflection, changing the way we look at the world, not refraining from action, but developing egoless action. So that, but that's easy to overlook if you're mesmerized by the external story.
Mm. I mean, there's no question that just the process of translating this great work, it's a monumental undertaking. But why? There are a lot of English translations of the Gita. Why did you feel it was necessary to produce this work called Gita, A Timeless Guide for Our Time? And just a reminder, our guest is the translator. It is Isaac Bentowicz. Thank you so much for joining us, and tell us, why did you think this was necessary?
Well, truth be told, you know, it's not that I, first of all, it was more than a decade. It's actually 12 years that I worked on the translation, and some 30 years that I'm fascinated disciple of reading deriving wisdom and solace from this scripture. This project began through these years was more an inner practice of just being fascinated by the scripture. I actually first translated it into Hebrew, and then after the Hebrew translation was done, translated it back into English. Hebrew is my first language, and so this was it was an exercise in of fascination with this scripture. As I did so through these years, as the scripture had this profound effect on my life, the scripture and the teachings that it so beautifully conveys, that it was a growing passion to share this fascination with others. There are many, many translations into English, well over 100 translations and hundreds of commentaries, and they're all, and many are good translations. Obviously, they each convey the viewpoint of the translator. This translation has the focuses on making the Gita applicable and accessible to readers of our time. And as such, it had several unique aspects which I thought may be of benefit to others as they have to me. Apparently, it is the first translation that translates the Gita in its original meter and rhyme. The scripture is called the Bhagavad Gita, the Song of the Divine. It's not the text of the divine or the lecture of the divine or the manuscript of the divine. It is the song of the divine. And, you know, like Song of Songs, like other wisdom teachings, there's a deep message here. The deeper wisdom is something that comes from our heart. It is not something we read in a book, but something that rather wakes up wisdom that already exists within us. This is why parables are used, because it cannot be conveyed as simple text, and that is why song is used. And so over these years, I enjoyed and was blessed to be immersed in slowly polishing these verses of wisdom back into their original meter and rhyme. Four lines of eight syllables each, typically, which beautifully convey these pearls of wisdom. In my meditations and with my students, I find that this melodic meter is not just a nicety. It is essential. I believe that these verses were meant to be meditated on, and when you read them in their melodious form, they really do roll around in your mind as polished pearls and do their thing. So hope that's not too poetic, but that was really the motivation.
I want to talk more about that, but I wanted to dive into something else regarding the translation. Now, you mentioned that you've translated the Gita into Hebrew. The original language of the Gita, Sanskrit?
Yeah.
Okay. So you had to study Sanskrit to start with.
Well, I did study Sanskrit, but I'm not a Sanskrit scholar. So I translated there several excellent translations by sages that are well versed in Sanskrit and that provided not just translation, but the translation that includes a word by word translation of each verse, as well as the overall meaning and commentary of the verse. I used one of these as to get to the Sanskrit, which is a translation by a sage called Swami Shivananda, who lived until the 60s. And so my knowledge of Sanskrit is enough in order to understand words here or there, but not at the level of depth that needed to understand the subtleties of the language. I saw my mission as leaving that to the giants of Sanskrit and taking the various commentaries and producing a volume, and as you've noted in your first introduction, one which is very thin, like the original, merely 700 poem verses, and try as best as I can to craft into these short form, poetic form, the essence of what is explained in these various commentaries and authoritative translations of the masters.
Just a side note: who wrote the Bhagavad Gita? Who is the source? Who sang the song that was then put down into words?
There is no author noted as such. Okay. The text talks about a sage called the Vyasa, who speaks from his intuition, conveys this dialogue between God and man, between Krishna and Arjuna, but there is no author as such that is stated for the Gita, same that in the Bible there is no author identified for it. It is acknowledged as a song of the divine, obviously written by man, but without the author being identified.
I want to touch upon one other aspect of the translation. You say your first language is Hebrew.
Yeah.
All right. And I know a limited amount about Hebrew, the alphabet, 22 characters. But what I do know is that each letter has its own legend, its own color, vibration, or tone, has its own numerical insignia, if you will, has its own meaning, for that matter, has its own story. Yeah. And then you start putting those characters together into words, creates a whole new legend, words into sentences, new legend, sentences into paragraphs, etc. Yeah. And so I'm wondering, as the phrase goes, there's a lot lost in translation. the just translating, for example, and in the context, for example, of what I know of the Bible and its translation, especially the Old Testament, let alone the New Testament from Aramaic, much is lost. There's a passage in the New Testament, for example, it's referred to as the rapture passage, where they'll be caught up to meet him in the air in the clouds of glory. A good friend of mine who is an author of a book called The Apocalypse Conspiracy, he was doing some research, and this is where the book came from. And the research on that passage, for example, and he pulls out his Bible, he pulls out his concordance, and he says there are two definitions of the word air, A-I-R. One of them is, you see the clouds float through, and we've got rain coming down here in Santa Barbara today, and the rain's falling through the air. The second definition is akin to God breathing the breath of life into the nostrils of Adam. And it is that definition, not the first one, but the second one, that is used in that rapture passage, which then basically states, if there is such a thing as a rapture, it's not an external event. And yet many, many Christians around the world believe that there's going to be this external event where Jesus is going to come for the second time, and a note here, there is no second listed in the New Testament. It says that Jesus will, or the Christ will, return, but it doesn't say how many times. Yeah. To catch them up in the clouds, in the air, in the clouds of glory. And of course, there's another definition of clouds of glory as well. So here we have a single passage that doesn't mean what the modern scholars and or commentators and ministers and pastors and preachers say it means. It means something totally different. So how were you able to maintain the essence of the Gita going from Sanskrit? And did you go straight from Sanskrit to English, or did you, I think you referred to the fact that you wrote it in Hebrew. Yeah. Did you go from Hebrew then to English?
Yeah. These are great questions. And then first, to before the question of how I try to keep it true to the original intent. Beautiful what you mentioned about the breath. I don't know if you or the listeners know this, but the original Hebrew words for this verse are actually saying exactly what you just mentioned. Wind is ruach in Hebrew. Ruach. Ruach is also the very same word for spirit. So in Hebrew, literally, spirit and wind are the same word. And so that's just to echo back what you've just said, both of the hidden meaning there and how things get lost in translation. And you also mentioned the uniqueness of the Hebrew language specifically, and indeed Hebrew and Sanskrit are holy languages. Holy languages means that the sounds of the language itself store energy that is beyond the arbitrary. It's not, and in fact, when you look at some of the Indian, the ancient India mantras seed the sounds, they are words in Hebrew, which correlate to the deep meaning of these sounds. So this is all fascinating. And lastly, my work here with the Gita, this is exactly right, and that was my guiding light. I was very careful in approaching this work. to keep in mind that I'm not conveying any ideas of my own. Rather, and because of the infinite depth of the spirit in this scripture, without knocking down any of the other any other modern translations or commentaries, it really depends how you look at the Gita. If you look at it, you may look at it as a historical text or as a cultural one. I belong to the school of thought that views it, as I mentioned earlier, as a guide for inner development. And so it is only enlightened established sages of inner development, well-versed in this culture and scripture that have the authority to find of the many meanings that each word in Sanskrit has, what is the meaning that makes sense. I merely followed in the footsteps of these masters and took what they articulated in these well-commentated translations of the Gita, and then put them in a way which is easily understood by a contemporary reader, but going to great lengths, doing the best I can so that it's not watered down. Lastly, I would say that part of this study of Gita is really a study of meditation and then the yoga and inner work. So when you which has been my life for the last 30 years. So it is with this context that and with the aid of the not aid, actually taking the commentaries of well-established and spiritual masters, not scholars and not professors, but spiritual teachers who have left the shining example of their own self-example of how they led their lives, and then using their understanding of the Gita and just putting it into a modern context. Perhaps one more thing that's important to say, while peeling away the many layers of culture and terminology, which make it very difficult to read the Gita in some of the other translations.
And it is a whole new world for a lot of folks, and we encourage you to investigate that world. Go to newgita.com, newgita.com. We will be linked to that website. The title is Gita, A Timeless Guide for Our Time, translated by Isaac Bentwich, and he is a doctor, a physician, and we are going to continue our conversation with him here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. And I only have one piece of advice for you. Stay tuned.
Imagine you could train your mind to be happy. Imagine you could flex your brain, teaching it to be relaxed, resolved, and creative. The Gita is an ancient text, one of the world's most trusted inner guides, which empowers you to do just that. It recounts the reflections of an Indian prince who is forced into a battle he does not wish to fight. But it is really a story about you and your daily struggles here and now. It echoes the inner voice of your soul, guiding you in the art of happiness, the art of living life wisely, transforming your life's challenges into opportunities for inner growth. All actions lead to wisdom, Prince, like wild rivers gushing into calm sea. Bit by bit, they purify your heart till wisdom divine dawns within. Now, a new poetic translation, carefully crafted over 12 years, captures for the first time Gita's magical melodiousness while speaking directly to men and women alike.
Tell me your stories, I'll do my best.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. And we encourage you to research everything that you are hearing on this program, to investigate to the best of your ability, because the whole point of what we're doing here is to educate you. I am working on being educated about much of what we are talking about here today, to better understand where we come from, where we're going, and for that matter, where we are. My goodness, we're just really, really struggling these days with a lot of different input into our daily lives, and it's one of those things that we really, I think it would behoove us all to sit back, relax, and meditate on some of these things. My guest here on the program is the translator of the Gita. Actually, it's Gita, A Timeless Guide for Our Time. And his name is Isaac Bentwich, and he is with us here on the program today. We're talking about the inner voice of your soul, which guides your ultimate journey. The Gita is one of the world's most trusted timeless guides for happiness, meditation, spiritual personal growth, and transformation, one which is ever so relevant today. And for example, Beethoven, Young, Leonard Cohen, Gandhi, these and many others of the world's most brilliant scientists, creative minds, and spiritual teachers found the Gita a source of wisdom and inspiration. I always take this seriously, Isaac, whenever I receive a copy of a book. And if they stick the PR information in the book, wherever they stick it, if it's in the front, okay, that's fine. But sometimes they'll slot it somewhere in the middle of the book. Just now, they're just putting it in the book. But I don't believe in coincidence. And so I would open the book up and, oh, that's interesting. And here's, it opens up actually to page 100 of the Gita, but it's the opposite page, 101. This is the book that enlightened me most in my whole life. It's Johann Wolfgang, and I'm not sure how to pronounce the last name, Goethe.
Goethe.
There you go. Shows you how much I know about his origins. Needless to say, it's fascinating from that standpoint. I'm curious about your origins spiritually or philosophically, let's put it that way. You say your original language is Hebrew. I'm going to make the false assumption, because I'm probably wrong, that you were born and raised Jewish.
Yes, that is correct. Yeah, I was born in Israel, born into the Jewish nation and faith. But as I mentioned earlier, and am very much connected to my Jewish roots. In fact, when I first read the Gita, I mentioned this in the introduction. When I first read the Gita some 32 years ago, this was in a month-long yoga teacher's training course. The only thing that I really hated about that course was the Gita. It's true. I read through it, and what have I to do with this Indian mythology? I was and remain very much connected to my Jewish roots, and it did not. It's only later that it really became the love of my life. Later in my training, I was very fortunate through my parents, my grandparent, and teachers, and noble teachers that have had the fortune to sit at their feet, who for me are shining examples of the Gita in action, that my path, I think, is one of great reverence to the wisdom that I see as common in the different religions and paths. When I went on a meditation retreat, a silence and meditation retreat for 2 months, one of these retreats was on the Mount of Beatitude. I live in Israel, so I have this fortune. And sitting every morning before the sunrise at the very spot where Christ is supposed to have given Sermon on the Mount, I read Sermon on the Mount and the Gita. So that's my path, I guess.
In my readings of people who have the Gita was part of their lives, I started out in my search, as I called it, back at the age of 17. I was always curious, but it was at that point that I was just really seeking, like everyone else. Didn't feel like I was lost. It's just I was curious, and I started reading my metaphysical primer, The Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramahansa Yogananda.
Yes.
And in subsequent years, of course, I've learned about how many, many people will sit down and they will use both the Gita and the Bible. They'll do comparisons and it's not to prove or disprove. It's, again, it's a process of inner growth. Yeah. And I'm curious, is there a way for us to do that if we want to try to maintain some level of context,
yes,
in our spiritual walk, if you will, how would we sit down to do that if we grew up in that in the Christian tradition, or even for that matter, as you, the Jewish tradition?
Yeah.
Are there ways that we can sit and literally be able to do that?
It's actually simpler and easier than one thinks, I think. Just reading through the Gita, this specific translation as an example, does that for you. You do not need to leave any beliefs, and certainly not your religion or culture behind.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of a crystal clear magnifying glass. These are all analogies of the intellect, and this is primarily not for the intellect, but food for the soul and the heart. But reading through it, your own culture and religions, the teachings of Christ, become much more clear and appealing. So this is the reason why I believe why it is appealed to so many people over some of the greatest scientists, physical quantum scientists, the greatest poets. And thinkers have been fascinated by this scripture. Perhaps I can read you a few verses. Let us listen to them. It sort of answers the question that the question that you posed.
Mm-hmm.
May I do that?
Please go right ahead. So, before you read that, I want to remind our listeners he's going to be reading from Gita, A Timeless Guide for Our Time, and again translated by our guest Isaac Bentwich. And go to newgita.com. Go right ahead, Isaac.
So just a few verses to give you the flavor of the scripture and the translation and why I say that it actually builds bridges to your heart and to where you are right now, to the religion or the path that you are walking, rather than the prince, the disciple, the prince begins this dialogue by saying, "A veil of pity routs my heart. My mind is dark. Where does my duty lay? Guide me, master. What ought I do? I'm your disciple. Show me the way. Not all the riches of earth know, nor attaining God's heavenly throne, can ease the grief that numbs my senses, remove this sorrow I've known. which sort of echoes what you've just asked, right? I have this teaching, I have that teaching. Should I? What about my religion or this new teaching? This confusion is there. And the answer, the master, the scripture goes on to say, "Thus spoke the brave warrior prince, conqueror of sleep, master of will. I shall not fight," he added, and then spoke no more and was still. Then to him, between the two armies, disconsolate by these tormenting trials, the master ruler of senses spoke, wearing the faintest of smiles. So you see, first of all, how this rhythmic, lullaby-like, mesmerizing music sort of sways you and touches your heart. And the master says, "You speak words of wisdom, O prince, but your sorrow is in vain. For the truly wise never mourn, neither the living nor the slain. There was never a time we were not, me or you or these enemy kings, nor can there be any future in which we ever cease being. This body dwellers throughout life, wears bodies of child, youth, old man. At death, he but dons another. The wise grieve not, they understand." Just one more verse. "Senses contacting their objects cause feelings of heat and cold, joy and pain to evince. They come and they go, they never last long. You must learn to bravely endure them, O prince." Isn't it lovely?
It's interesting because, and again, I don't believe in coincidence. I do believe in coincidences. Because that's what happens, is things coincide and they happen together for a reason. We don't always know that. It's fascinating because as you were reading the first paragraph, in this time, though I have not lost sight of my life's purpose, about that which I love doing, there's been this sort of undercurrent of, I don't want to say sadness per se, but more of feeling the need to slow down. And this isn't something that I feel the need to do for the rest of my life. But for some reason, in this period, in these months, in these days and so forth, in these hours, I get this recurring impression, this recurring, persistent, intuitive guidance. Slow down. Just slow down. Everything's fine. You don't need to rush here or there, be speedy at this or that. Right now, if you slow down, then you're not only going to see and hear the things you need to, but you are going to flow through whatever turbulence might come your way. With less discomfort, if you will.
And
it's one of those things where we struggle as human beings with what we refer to as the negative emotions. But I put it in a, and of course this has to do with the whole discussion about duality. And of course that's spoken of in these paragraphs that you've read, these stanzas that you have read. And I've come to the conclusion that there is no duality. I mean, even it talks about duality, that this is all an illusion. It's Maya. And I look at the macro, and this is the only way that I can phrase this, the macro, the mid-cro, and the micro cosmic worlds. And the mid-cro is us at our level. And I look at the macro cosmic world, and I see, looking through the Hubble telescope, I can see all these great celestial bodies. I see all the movement. I see the collisions. I see the explosions. I see the near hits, and on and on and on. And I marvel, wow, ooh, ah. We see that when a meteor shower, you know, these different meteor showers that are predicted, and we see them at night, and we just sit there like fireworks, ooh, ah. And sometimes when we're looking at the micro level through a telescope, an electron telescope, electron microscope, I should say, and we're seeing a healthy biology, if you will, of whatever it is we're looking at, plant or animal or mineral. And we marvel at that, too. Oh, wow, that's pretty neat. Look at that. Wow, that's incredible. What a shape. But when we look at the micro, since I can't think of a different word for that, we go, oh, no, no, please. Or we're, yeah, obviously we're happy. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. The universe on the two extreme levels has no judgment about what is happening. It does not pass judgment, nor does it get emotional when two planets collide or a star goes supernova or whatever the events are that are going on out there. It just is. And so when I start to look at my life, and this is where the whole impression of slowing down comes in, I start to see that things just are the way they are. When people get wrapped up, for example, in the political discussion of our time, I say 100, 1,000, 10,000 years from now, none of this is going to matter. No one's even going to care that it even happened. So let it go. And I think that the greatest example for me was that I heard a comment made by our president again for the third or fourth or fifth time over the last 4 years, disparaging another individual. And my heart went out to him. That is the president going, that's so sad. I don't hate you. You know, I'm not a real fan of your behavior, but I almost pity you that you have to be like this. You don't have to be like this. None of us has to be like this. Taking it away from the personal and bringing it into the general population, we don't have to be like this. In spite of what I keep hearing from other people, Isaac, that, that's just human nature. Well, but that's not our true nature, is it? I mean, and even the Gita would confirm that human nature isn't our true inner nature, is it?
That's really the essence of the Gita teachings. We all have this lower animal nature. We have the mind, which is a great computing machine, but left to its own devices, manifests as intellect and ego, and is our lower nature, and results in friction and wars and unhappiness in the world, which is the realm our bodies live in. But our true nature, our higher divine nature, is what we aspire to wake up to. You mentioned the duality and that and the three aspects. The Gita again is exactly about that. You know, the Gita is divided into three parts. The first six chapters of the 18 is the path of action. The middle one, you mentioned the micro, the middle one, and the macro. So, as the first path is the path of action. The second is the path of devotion or path of the heart, and the third path is the path of wisdom, and wisdom here means non-duality. In the Indian culture, it is called, or terminology, it is called Advaita Vedanta, and the wisdom of non-duality. And the Gita is beautiful that way, in that it has these three pillars, if you will, which makes it so applicable to our times. We're living in difficult and challenging and times, but also times of great potential and of spiritual awakening. Mm. And so these three pillars are essential, because the first pillar, the path of action, is a practical guide. How do I go to work tomorrow? how do I treat an abusive boss or success or failure in the world? The second path is the path of the heart, the path of devotion. It is now turning inside, going beyond intellect, and opening our emotional intelligence and awakening the intuition, which is the only way we can realize deeper truth, as we discussed at the beginning of this talk, of truths that are hidden in the our scriptures, in our very own scriptures. They're hidden because they need intuition to understand them. Understand is, by definition, the wrong word. Understand, it's lower. So this is overstand in a sense. Mm-hmm. And lastly, the path of wisdom. And this is the path of non-dual wisdom. Ultimately, we begin this path looking for happiness outside, and viewing ourselves as a limited body-mind separated from the world around us and immersed in it. We aspire towards, through this path, to find a unity which we at first are blind to. Then we get glimpses of it by seeing a unity outside us in nature, but still identifying ourselves as separate. And finally, merging and melting into this unity, which was indivisible in the first place, as though waking up from a nightmare of this separateness that has been with us these many years.
There is no question in my mind that, as I said before, we can use all the help we can get. There is no question about that. But as you stated, you know, we are living in challenging times. By the same token, I don't know that there hasn't been a time in our human history that we haven't been. I mean, we put these markers at certain places, granted, but at the same time, even the supposed gay 20s, the prosperous 20s, and then the prosperous 50s of the 1900s, you know, supposedly those were good times, you know. But there were still people who felt like, oh, we were living in challenging times. And as the, the old Chinese proverb, may you live in interesting times. I don't know that there isn't a time in our history that hasn't been interesting. I guess it just depends upon how much certain events, if you will, affect an individual's life. I mean, when I take a look at the British royalty and the medieval times, well, if you lived anywhere in that realm, those were interesting times. But if you lived on an island somewhere, they weren't quite as interesting from that context.
Yeah.
So it's really a matter of perspective. And what we here on this program try to do is we try to take a look at for example, a particular event in the center of a circle. And what we try to do is we try to move from one point to the next on that circle, to get a perspective, a broader perspective of that event, if you will. And this is, to me, part of the problem we have today, in spite of how connected we are, how much information there is out there, that, as it has been said, you can have 10 people see a car accident, a car wreck, and you're going to get 10 different descriptions, and that's fine. But today, those descriptions are labeled almost, they're not opinion, they're not, that was my observation, they're labeled as fact, as the truth. The truth is incomplete if you haven't seen it, if you will, from as many perspectives on that circle as is possible. And so we're doing ourselves a disservice. And that's one of the reasons why Christianity has the Bible. Judaism has the Old Testament, the Torah. The Muslims have the Quran. Who does the Gita belong to as far as philosophy?
I'm encouraging us all to embrace it as ours, because it is. It is a scripture that is written, is spoken eye level to each and every one of us on our individual inner journeys. Many verses in it, in one way or another, speak of these different scriptures as different facets of the same thing, and it is a guidebook that allows us to find the deep wisdom which is in our hearts through meditation and with the help of the Gita. We learn to go beyond the deadening noise of our thoughts and emotions and mind, and once that subsides even a little bit, we hear the still silent a song of wisdom that comes from within. And there's something very comforting and empowering in that, because we don't need to go anywhere; we're already there. And because in that knowledge, the differences between us, between different nations, different religions, different people, like you mentioned, we each have our different thoughts, and as long as we live in the mind. And outside, there's bound to be friction. We can keep trying to resolve this friction outside, or we can look for scriptures like the Gita and practices that they prescribe to find a peace within that in which presence these differences outside sort of begin to melt.
A timeless guide for our time, it's Gita. Isaac Bentwich is my guest, and he is the translator of this wonderful work, and we encourage you to go to newgita.com to find out more. Your happiness does not depend on any teachings, gurus, or religions. Gita's still clear voice echoes the inner voice of your soul, guiding you on an inner journey that will unleash your full potential, empowering you to do good in the world and to be transformed in the process, to change the world around you by first changing the world within. And that word transform was sort of foisted upon me in one of my interviews not too long ago, Isaac. You know, we were talking about this, that, and the other thing. And yeah, we want to change our lives. We want to, you know, make this a better world. And they said, well, change, that's a nice word. But if it can be changed one direction, it can be changed back. So maybe you
that's
might
right.
want to consider, this was not a hard and fast, but they said you might want to consider changing that word to transform. Because once it's transformed, it's less likely to be transformation is to something different. And if you were to transform back, well, that would just be to change it back, and you wouldn't want to do that. So I liked what they were saying, and so I've been working on incorporating that word instead of change to transform, especially in this context of our inner growth and of who we really are. Before we let you go here, I want to ask you, from your perspective as a seeker, I will use the term loosely here, as a metaphysician, as a seeker of that which is beyond the physical, what is your observation of the coming evolution of man? Where do you think we might be? The possibilities are obviously wide open, but from your perspective, people, if they begin this process of getting into more of a meditative and contemplative life, inner work and so forth, more and more people do this, where do you think we're going to be in 100, 500, maybe 1,000 years?
Well, Look, as you mentioned, I am a medical doctor by training, and have been an entrepreneur these many years. I've founded and led several successful technology companies, so I was immersed in that world. One of my companies actually dealt with analyzing the human genome using powerful computing. So all of this, being with feet firmly placed on concrete ground, has been my life, this life. But I do believe that there is a bigger story, that beyond the evolution as Darwin articulated it, there is a spiritual evolution as well. There is a process of awakening, which is inevitable. It is inevitable in each and every one of us. We can control its pace. We can continuing to resist the natural flow, which is a flow upwards and inwards, towards our source, towards our soul. We can slow this process, but we cannot stop it. And the same is true for mankind. We're living in a fortunate time in that while dark and turbulent, it is also a time of awakening. Time itself, you say, in 100 years or 1,000 years, let's remember that time itself is a construct of the mind. And we are seeking that which is not in the mind, but which the mind is in that. But be that as it may, by tuning into the silence that's within, both each of us and as individuals, as well as by helping our fellow humans, as well as a culture, I believe there is a process of awakening. Perhaps one last verse that relates directly to this question. Silent mind is awake to inner self, which is but darkness to the ignorant's sight. The ignorant to sense life are awake, daylight for them, a seer's dark night. So it's up for us to choose whether we want to continue to live in the dark, or whether we want to tune in towards the light that ever shines in our heart.
I thank you so much, Isaac Bentwich. I thank you so much for joining us here on the program. This has been a fascinating conversation, and I know you're all the way in Israel, but should you ever find yourself in the States, here on the central coast of California, we would love to have you in studio to continue this conversation. I would love to continue this and talk more in detail about some of the wonderful messages, if you will, and stories of the Gita that we can elucidate on in the near future.
Good. I'd love that. Thank you for the opportunity and for the lovely conversation and for the wonderful work that you're doing. I'm pleased to be able to contribute.
Thank you very much for joining us. And I want to remind our listeners that I have three final questions for you, but I want to remind our listeners that you're going to want to listen to the entire interview. If you're listening to the radio broadcast, you better go to the podcast, because there's a whole lot more that we talk about. Great, great stuff. The title of the book, once again, Gita, A Timeless Guide for Our Time. And go to newgita.com, translated by my guest, Isaac Bentwich, MD. And I was going to get into a lot of that aspect of your medical experience and so forth, but I really wanted to touch upon your experiences with the Gita. I have to say that when I was reading about your bio and your medical background, the one question that always comes to mind when I hear about these different research milestones, if you will, you know, at one point, you know, we had the test tube baby and cloning and all these kinds. And the one question that, it doesn't matter what part of our world it is, my question always is, just because we can, does that mean we should? But unfortunately, we'll have to save that one for another time. But I think that would be a fascinating area to dive into. And maybe the Gita has an answer for us.
Next time we'll go into it in greater detail, and I'd be happy to delighted to do so.
All right. Well, first,
thank you once again.
Oh, you're very welcome. Let me ask you the first of three questions, and again, yep. We'll let you go. First question is: who is Isaac Bentwich?
Isaac Bentwich is a label put on a baby that grew to be a boy and then a man, and so we're conditioned from young age to say I am Isaac Bentwich. And Gita reminds us, I am.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
The Gita has taught me that the greatest thing one can hope for, and certainly what I hope for, is to stop hoping.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
I hope it doesn't sound too corny, but the first thing that comes to mind is to share the passion of the light that has been brought into my life by the Gita. Certainly, that's something I'm very passionate about.
Isaac Bentwich, thank you again for joining us here on the program. It's been a great pleasure to have you here, and I encourage our listeners to go to newgita.com to pick up a copy, to read more, to get in touch with Isaac, all the way from Israel here on this program. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love, Talal.